From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We travel back in time today.
Remember the advice your father gave you on your wedding day.
If you ever travel back in time, don't step on anything, because even the tiniest change can alter the future in ways you can't imagine.
We'll hear about a summer camp that teaches kids hundreds of years of Georgia history through time travel. Then we go back to 1930s Alabama and learn about a lawyer's fight for justice. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we spoke with journalist Mike King yesterday about how Georgia's decision not to expand Medicaid affects the state's urban hospitals.
We're turning down about $9 million a day going back to the federal treasury because we have this ideological opposition to Obamacare, simply on the basis that we just don't like anything associated with Obamacare.
Do you think politics gets in the way of funding our public hospitals? Here are your first thoughts. Mars the Hunter tweets, money should be the last concern for public health policy, or maybe the greater good is too socialist for this country. Sam Burnham writes, opposition to Obamacare is opposition to government spending and control, not Obama. And Robbie Medwed replies, I'm guessing Renee Unterman learned it's better to help people than end up as one of Samantha Bee's targets again. Late night host Samantha Bee previously poked fun at Georgia State Senator Renee Unterman's stance on rape kit testing during her show Full Frontal.
If the Confederate clown car that is the Georgia House could come together on this bill, who are you to block it?
We always love to hear what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Is there a better way to learn about history than to travel back in time? I think not. Kids at the first ever time travelers camp on Jekyll Island get to do that. Well, metaphorically speaking, they explore a different period of the island's history every day. The camp is hosted by the Jekyll Island Museum, and it's in its second session. The first one was last week. Here to tell us about it is Bruce Piatek. He's Director of Historic Resources at the Jekyll Island Authority. Hi there, Bruce.
Hey, good morning.
And also with us is Haley Comaromi. Comaromi, is that right, Haley?
Yeah.
She's an intern at the Jekyll Island Museum and a counselor at the Time Travelers Camp. Thanks for speaking with us, Haley.
Yeah, no problem.
And I understand, Haley, that, I mean, to say that you're an intern at the museum and a counselor sounds really official, but you have to dress in costumes each day.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's just one day. For Colonial Day, I dress up in my indentured servant garb.
Which is what? What does an indentured servant costume look like?
So it has a petticoat. It's pretty basic, like what you would imagine from a colonial era. I have my bodice. I have my bonnet because my hair has to be covered. And I have my apron and stockings.
And you're really hot.
Yes, I am.
And you have to stay in character.
Yeah.
For the
yeah.
full day.
It's really fun because last week I had a kid actually convinced that I was someone who came back from the 1700s.
Wow. Yeah. You must be a good actor there.
Which well, thank you.
I guess, Bruce, means that you, when you're hiring interns, you need to find people who can act.
Well, that's part of it. I think we just got very fortunate with Haley.
So, Bruce, what's the thought process behind this? As I understand, you look at a different era in Jekyll Island, history specifically, each day for 5 days in these camps. Why this approach?
Well, it gives us a chance to give our campers kind of an overall sense of the history of Jekyll Island, which is the history of Georgia as well. And so by taking a different time period, we can focus on that and do some fun activities and give them a chance for a little dip in the history pool to see what life was like during those different eras. And so and Jekyll Island has an immense and interesting history, and we can only scratch the surface with our campers, but we try to do that so that they have a good time and we sneak a little learning in while they're having fun.
But, you know, I mean, the typical way that a museum teaches history is indoors. You can show films, you can show them artifacts, you have lectures and people talking to them. Doing something like this seems like it's infinitely more complicated and difficult. What makes it worth it?
Well, I think it's the benefit that the children get by participating, and it gives us, you know, museums are moving out of sort of that stodgy mode that a lot of us think of, you know, dioramas and things in glass cases.
Dioramas.
Yeah, you remember those, I'm
yeah.
sure. So, you know, what we're trying to do is really make the history of Jekyll Island more relevant to people and to get them, to get particularly our our young kids more engaged with understanding history and being able to relate and with all their senses to the activities that went on and what life was like during some of these different time periods. So, you know, if you're hot and uncomfortable and you're out there at the Horton House, you get a little sense of what it was like this time of year for somebody in the, you know, in the 1700s that was an indentured servant out there at Horton House and, you know, not only having to deal with the heat, but, you know, you can't stop and get a cold drink anywhere because there wasn't any ice. So, you know, there are all these things that folks don't think about, but it gives us a chance to sort of help immerse these kids in what that experience might have been like so that they can relate better. And I think that they learn a lot more by participating and seeing things. And, you know, movies are great, but a chance to get out there and actually feel and do is a lot more fun.
So, Monday is Colonial Day. And, Haley, was there anything in particular that kids learned that really surprised them?
So they were able to card wool and spin wool, and make butter. I think having that hands-on experience, like, they learned it and they were able to really get a sense of what it was like.
And maybe think twice when they're putting their clothes on.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so then Tuesday you move into the Age of Invention, mm-hmm. and you put here, Bruce, a very modern term, which is a steampunk. they make steampunk top hats and paper airplanes. What does that teach them about history?
Well, this is really, we're trying to get them to think about how technology was invented. And during this period, there was a lot of, you know, focusing on mechanization and modernization and technology. We think about today as a really technical age, and it is, but it also was in the 1890s. There were a lot of new things coming online, new industries being created. And people learning about new things like, you know, flight and how wings worked and how you could get something that was heavier than air off the ground.
Okay, so then we move into Wednesday, which is Pirate Day. Haley, I'm assuming Pirate Day is the favorite day. Is that?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah, and speaking of costumes, the other camp counselor, she dresses up in full pirate garb for that one.
Which is also probably pretty hot.
Yes, it is.
And then you move into the Roaring Twenties. Mm-hmm. Bruce, is that right?
That's correct.
And then you end with the 50s.
Yes.
Which I'm sure to young people, these kids are between the ages of 8 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
The 1950s probably feels like 300 years ago.
I'm sure it does. It was forever ago.
So tell me, give me an example of an activity that you do for the 50s day.
Well, they do some work on oral histories to learn about how to interview people and find information from them. And so that gets them involved. They get involved with some of the playgrounds because Jekyll Island was really named the playground that belonged to every Georgian. And so we bring up that theme and talk about it. And this is, you know, the kind of the early development of Jekyll Island as both a state park and a resort type of facility. And then we do something kind of fun with them at the end as we do hula hooping and limbo contests. So those were kind of popular activities in that time period.
I have to imagine an 8-year-old is better at limbo, Haley, than most of the counselors.
Yes, they definitely beat all of us.
Yeah. So, Haley, tell me about the reaction of some of the kids, and does it evolve as the days go by?
Yeah, I think it definitely does, because Colonial, I don't think they're as interested in that, but, you know, you get to pirates, and I see the enthusiasm growing. I remember last week they were building forts out of, like, straws, and they were, like, plastic straws, so they were able to build a big fort that they could fit into.
Out of plastic straws?
Well, it was for fort building. They weren't actually plastic straws.
Okay.
But they kind of looked like that. So they were able to build that fort and decorate it. And they were really enthusiastic. Like, a kid gets to build a fort. But before that, they were able to tour through the historic district and see a bunch of architectural designs. And they incorporated that into their forts that they were building.
Oh, that's really cute.
Yeah.
Bruce, we only have about 30 seconds, but are you kind of doing what you would have wanted as a kid?
Yes, I think that's true.
I suspected that all along. That is,
yeah.
Bruce Piatek, Director of Historic Resources at the Jekyll Island Authority, and Haley Kamaromi is Camp Counselor at the Time Travelers Camp. The camp extends through this Friday. Thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you.
70,000 bodies are buried in the heart of Atlanta at Oakland Cemetery. Residents include former mayors and governors, Gone with the Wind author Margaret Mitchell, and golf legend Bobby Jones. But most of the occupants are lesser-known people from Atlanta's history. Our producer Linda Chen paid a visit to Oakland Cemetery to learn about one.
William Jasper Franklin, better known as the Goat Man, was born in 1849 and lived in Atlanta for most of his life post-Civil War.
That's David Moore. He's executive director of the Historic Oakland Foundation.
He had meningitis, so he couldn't walk. He was struck with that disease as a young man. And so his father made him a little cart that he could ride around in, pulled by a goat. The goat's name was Pete. William Jasper Franklin made his living selling pencils and apples at the downtown steps of the downtown courthouse. And he was sort of one of these characters that you always count on. He was always there. Just sort of that wonderful, quirky character that I think every town has and becomes the fabric of the community.
The Goat Man was beloved, but there was a time that he stirred up panic in the city.
He disappeared. He and his goat, they weren't downtown anymore. He was missed so much that the Atlanta Constitution's headline was Goat Man Missing. Relatives fear foul play. So his mother, he would always meet his mother down at the public wells to get water to take back to his home, and when he didn't show up, she called the police, and they really thought somebody had taken him and, you know, taken his goat. But a couple of 3 days later, he came back into town, kind of triumphant return, and all hell the gate, our goat man is back. Where'd you go? Where'd you go? He wouldn't say. It was his little secret. And the secret died with Mr. Franklin. He never told anybody. So I think we're all entitled to our secrets, even celebrities like him.
William Jasper Franklin and his parents are buried at Oakland Cemetery, but until recently they didn't have headstones. The Historic Oakland Foundation honored the Goat Man's place in Atlanta history with three markers for him and his family last month.
I think one of the most sincerest of human longings is the desire to be remembered, or another way of saying it, not be forgotten. And so I think that that desire to be remembered by whatever means, and I think here at a cemetery, one of the ways we remember is to mark the graves with the stones, with the names and the dates of those that came before. But it also gives us a little glimpse into our history. So it's important on several levels.
Oakland Cemetery was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1976. That story is part of our ongoing series about historic sites in Georgia to celebrate the National Park Service's centennial year. If you know about a historic Georgia park or monument that we should feature, tweet us. We are at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. On this day, 35 years ago, the man suspected of carrying out one of the most grisly crimes in American history was arrested.
In Atlanta, murder charges were filed today against 23-year-old Wayne Williams for the most recent death in a string of 28 murders of young blacks over the past 2 years.
Wayne Williams was the prime suspect in the disappearance and murder of 23 black children in Atlanta over a 2-year period. The incident is known as the Atlanta Child Murders. Williams is serving a life sentence in prison for other murders, but he's always maintained his innocence of the child murders. Here he is in an interview with CNN where he was asked about why he called young black kids, quote, drop shots.
That does not make me a murderer simply because I said somebody is a drop shot or because I called him a drop shot. That does not make Wayne Williams a murderer because I say somebody is a street urchin. You know, come on, we're talking about murder. The fact is, I didn't kill anybody.
I talked about the Atlanta child murders on this show in April. My guest was Jeanine Nabors, whose play Serial Blackface is about the murders. I also spoke with author Tayari Jones. Her novel Leaving Atlanta is told through the perspective of several children whose peers went missing. And reporter Dale Russell of Fox 5 Atlanta joined us to look back on the murders, which he covered. I started off asking him why there's still debate over the number of victims.
That's a difficult topic just right there. It was a 2.5-year long string of murders in the city of Atlanta that began with young teenage black boys and over time slowly evolved into older young adults. But it was a city that was gripped with fear at the time. I can tell you that. It was just astonishing for the press corps, for the government, for the police. Nobody had seen anything like this. Because you have to remember, this was a point in time where there was no Silence of the Lamb. There were no FBI profilers. The community didn't really know a lot about serial killers.
Right.
And all of a sudden, we had children ripped from our streets that were dying. In the beginning, the first two bodies were found together 100 yards apart from each other in 1979. To the end of the string of murders, that was literally a child or an older young adult being killed almost once a week. So imagine that. Mm-hmm. Once a week, a young man has lost his life. And the city was turned upside down.
And Janine, this becomes fertile ground for you dramatically, at least. Which part of the Atlanta child murders did you want to investigate through art?
Well, for me, I was always interested in the story of the mother. When I was looking at the research, when I was doing my research the year and a half before I started writing the play, I saw that one of the victims had never been found. His body was never found. And for me, that was kind of the catalyst for Vivian, the mother in my play, for Serial Blackface, because she is so restless with her need to try to find her son, but also the discomfort that she has remaining with her daughter. And that was my way into the play. The child that was never found.
And Tayara, you had a similar but distinct approach through your novel, Leaving Atlanta, which is that you tried to imagine what it was like for kids here, not just their families, but the kids specifically who were afraid to be alone, to be walking through the streets of Atlanta. Why, Tayari, do the Atlanta child murders that took place so long ago, why do they still have such an impact?
It's funny, you said I had to imagine what it was like for the children. Actually, I didn't have to imagine. I grew up in Atlanta in 1979. I was 9 years old, and two of the children who were abducted were students in my elementary school. So for me, this was really me writing, my coming-of-age story. My way of looking at the murders was I was curious as to how these murders issued my generation into our adolescence, because we were 9, 10 years old. We were right at the cusp. And what did that teach us about the world, and how has that made us the people we are today?
So, Dale, you spoke with a number of families and people in Atlanta while you were covering this, and even after Wayne Williams went to prison. What kind of things were people telling you?
It was terrifying for these families. I can remember one case where there was a child missing. We all went to the home. I went to the home originally. I was there by myself. Then some other reporters heard about the case. And all of a sudden, there were 4 or 5 reporters on the porch waiting with a mother to find out whether or not her child was going to be returned or found dead. And just sitting in her home talking with her, I can remember it vividly even to this day, how emotionally draining it was for this mother of a young child. And in her case, the child was found. And he was returned, and it was a glorious ending to it. But I can remember sitting on that porch thinking how devastating this was for the families to have these children just disappear, sometimes in the middle of mostly in the middle of the day. In fact, it wasn't somebody coming in at night. These children were just swept off the streets, going about their normal daily routines.
At times when they thought they were safe. So, Janine, what kind of research did you have to do to get into the minds of people during this time?
Well, I have family that lives in Atlanta, and my brother and sister were both very much, in school at the time of the Atlanta child murders. So I spoke to my family in Atlanta first. Then I went through my parents and my brothers. I read a lot of research online, and when I actually started writing the play, a lot of people, I was a student at Juilliard, and a lot of people were talking me out of writing it because they were like, well, why is it relevant now? I mean, this thing happened so many years ago. And at that time, Trayvon Martin happened. And that was kind of the catalyst that really lit a fire underneath me to kind of continue with this story, because I do think that Black Lives Matter is very much kind of like a the same type of thing that's happening back then.
You mean this feeling? Like, yeah, this feeling that African American kids particularly have that they're not safe, which is interesting because we got a tweet from April B, who says, "As a kid, it was difficult to process the racial component of the killings. I simply didn't feel the same threat as my classmates." And Tayari, how do we process? Wayne Williams is African American. How do we process the racial component of this? And especially for you, growing up, feeling like you, in particular, because of the color of your skin, are less safe than your friends.
You know, the thing about it is that children do not understand themselves as historical. This is why the child murders, I believe, was actually more traumatic for our parents. Like, when the murders started happening, this is just after civil rights. Our parents look at the murders and they think lynching, right? They have this historical understanding. But as children, we saw it as classmates. Like, we didn't, as a child, we didn't process it in the same racial way. I mean, that in many ways was kind of the way it was our coming of age. But I think that the piece that I really think we must talk about is that this was a case that also introduced the idea of socioeconomic class in the African American community. Keep in mind that in the early 80s in Atlanta, we had black mayor, black police chief. You know, when my father moved here to Atlanta, you know, the idea was that they had black everything. It was supposed to be the black Mecca, that we had a black dog catcher. Everybody was black. And so part of the conflict that emerged was that the mothers felt marginalized because they were not of Atlanta's black bourgeois elite. Mm. And this was really the first time that the city, in a big public way, had to grapple with the idea that just the word black didn't say everything that was happening.
We would love to hear from those of you listening. If you lived in Atlanta during that two-year child murder episode, what do you remember about that time? Tweet us at OST Talk, or you can join the conversation on Facebook. Lil Mike SF tweets, "I was a kid and very creeped out by the news, but not old enough to understand the truly toxic implications." And he tagged you in that tweet, Tayari. April B says, "It was a scary time. I was in the fifth grade when the killing started. My dad gave us green ribbons to wear to honor the victims." And Meg Donahue tweets, "My family moved down from Boston in 1982. The only thing my mother knew about Atlanta was Gone with the Wind and these murders. Suffice it to say, she wasn't thrilled about moving to Georgia." And we heard from Michelle Ryder Kosiba, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Michelle, on Facebook. She says, "I remember I was a preteen and I was scared and sad. The reality of never seeing your child or a child never to see their parents again really hit the heart." We're speaking about the long-term impacts of Atlanta child murders. My guests are playwright Janine Neighbors, author Tayari Jones, and Fox 5 Atlanta reporter Dale Russell. Dale, there is still to this day argument over whether Wayne Williams is responsible for these murders. Why is it not settled?
I think for several reasons. One, there was always there was a certain group of reporters and activists and parents that just never could accept Wayne Williams as the killer from the get-go. You would have to know Wayne. He was a very unassuming young man in many ways. He was he wasn't terrifying looking. He wasn't scary looking. He looked sort of meek and mild. So he didn't fit the picture that we all were developing in our minds
of
who
is
this gruesome monster that are killing the children. He was also, and I think Tayara just said it perfectly, he was the child of two school teachers. So he was sort of in the middle class, upper middle class of the community. Nobody expected the killer to be this guy. I mean, he just didn't fit the image. And there was absolutely a racial component to it, that there were a lot of people that were never going to accept that the killer was black, and there were a lot of people that were never going to accept, frankly, that if the killer were white. So it was sort of a torn community, if you will. And as the murders were unfolding over a 2.5-year period, nobody knew what we were going to find at the end of it. And then his trial alone was very confusing for a lot of people because he was actually convicted for killing two young adults, a 27-year-old and 21-year-old, Nathaniel Cato and Jimmy Ray Payne.
Yeah.
But what a lot of people don't know is during that trial was evidence introduced against 10 other victims, 9 of whom were children. And the trial, the child murder trial, really took place within the confines of that trial of two murder victims in their 20s. We heard evidence of 10 other murders, 9 of whom were children. That was truly the story of that 2.5-year period, if you sat through the entire trial.
Janine, Does Wayne Williams' guilt or not or innocence matter dramatically when we're writing this play?
I think because so many people that I had spoken with were conflicted with whether they thought he was guilty or innocent, I decided to kind of take that out of the play and just focus on the remainder, like what was happening with the mother and the daughter and the trauma. But I did want to put danger on stage. So for me, the man with the face is a representation of the danger that can come into your home when you're, you know, not around your children, and what happens when you, this idea of like not knowing that Black people were dangerous. You know, I think there was a time where these people were very much about their home life and looking at each other for community. And so what this play does is kind of show the breakdown of community.
And Tayari, this is something that you alluded to earlier. There were a number of other theories about who was responsible. People thought the KKK were committing these crimes. That was thought for a very long time. And I wanted you to respond to Janine's idea that for many African American kids, especially, it was other African Americans that were supposed to be safe. They were supposed to be the people you turned to.
And I think they still are and still were. I mean, I do think that I do think there was a sense that African Americans were not serial killers, which is very different than saying that African Americans thought African Americans were harmless, right? Even in my book, in my novel Leaving Atlanta, the kids are theorizing and the kids are like repeating their parents saying, I get how somebody might cut you over their woman, but this is different. So it wasn't as though we were strangers to violence, but the idea that this kind of perverse, motiveless crime, I wasn't interested dramatically in whodunit, because I think that when you structure a story around finding the killer, the protagonist becomes the police, and you end up making a work of art in service of the state. I did not want to write a novel where the main character is the state. I was very interested in the ways that the community adapted and in many ways came together. Because, you know, if you think about it, remember the Committee to Stop the Children's Murders, the Mother's Organization? And they were like a kind of lay woman's children's defense fund. That came about because of the murders. So in many ways, community came together as well.
I wanted to read an email I got from Kathy Lohr, a journalist who reminds us of Karen Slaughter, who's a best-selling crime novelist, grew up in Atlanta. Karen Slaughter is white. Kathy Lohr says this: the murders led to her interest in crime. There was so much fear, she said. She couldn't go out and play or ride bikes. Kids were missing. Nobody knew what was going on and why. It was real fear to people who lived here, and especially because when these kids grew up in this environment. And that would be the standing question, Dale, is how long will this impact go on? Is this a generational thing, or is this a fear people might pass on?
You know, it's interesting. I actually think that when I talk to young journalists that are coming into Atlanta, they don't know anything about this. Mm-hmm. They've heard something randomly about some children. They don't know the horror that this city went through. I think arguably the most traumatic historical crime event in the city's history. I think a lot of people have forgotten it. It doesn't resonate today like it did back then. That's what I think is so great when a playwright sits down, when an author sits down and writes a novel or a play about that time, because they can get into the story, as you've heard both authors say, that they can get into a story in a way that just a factual recitation, a Wikipedia,
or a documentary,
of the story just can't. And so I think it's tremendous that we have people that look at that period of time, see how incredibly dramatic it was. It is a story of crime, of race, of class. There's so much that was going on in the city at the time. And I've read the play and I've read the book, and I can tell you, I think they both have done a very good job of capturing the feeling of the city at that point in time.
That is Dale Russell. He's a senior IT reporter at Fox 5 Atlanta. We spoke with Tayari Jones, author of Leaving Atlanta, and Ginny Neighbors, whose play Serial Blackface is about the murders. Thanks so much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. The character Atticus Finch was a hero in his kids' eyes, and he's been a hero to children all around the world who've read To Kill a Mockingbird or seen the film adaptation.
In this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Harper Lee's story of a gentlemanly Southern lawyer who defends a black man charged with the rape of a white woman may be a work of fiction, but our next guest says Atticus Finch might be based on a real person, his father. Joe Beck is an Atlanta-based lawyer and author of the book My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. It comes out today. Joe, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
When did you first make the connection between the character of Atticus Finch and your dad?
When I was growing up in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the town we had to move to after my father's law practice and enterprise dried up, the people would hear about this case and hear me talking about it all through high school, college, and immediately say that that must be To Kill a Mockingbird, because it was a trial by my father representing a black man charged with raping a white woman in a small South Alabama town where violence was threatened, and it just seemed to have a lot in common with that case. But it was many years later when I began to really pursue this. It occurred on a fishing trip with the man who turned out to be the agent for Harper Lee. I didn't know that when we went fishing together, but when he heard this story, he said, I want Nell, as he called her, to respond to this.
Nell was her first name, Nell Harper Lee.
Yes, and he knew I was just trying to find out information about my father, and of course the story of what he did was public. Ms. Lee wrote back a very gracious letter. She said there are some obvious parallels, and she saw those. She said she didn't recall the book. Recall the case, but she was very interested in helping me. And one of the things she suggested was that there would probably be no newspaper coverage, and therefore it would be hard to find out about the case. But she was wrong about that. There was a lot of coverage because the trial was surrounded by 16 Alabama Highway Patrolmen to preserve order and basically to prevent a lynching. The defendant was himself removed from the jail in Troy, Alabama, and taken to Montgomery for what the newspaper calls safekeeping. Now, my father was a lawyer in Enterprise, Alabama, which is about 50 miles from Troy. And the reason he got the case was because the lawyers in Troy had themselves appointed special prosecutor or came up with other conflicts. They did not want to take this controversial case. My father...
Let's take the story step by step here, Joe, because one of the things you state very early on in the book, and I want to be careful because the book almost reads like a novel. It's all factual and a memoir, but I don't want to give away what happens. But at the beginning, you're very careful to say that your father and grandfather weren't sort of crusading anti-racism men, and you tried to establish that quite early. Why?
You say they were or were not. I couldn't understand.
Were not. In relation to your grandfather, you were saying, look, don't put either of these men on a pedestal.
Well, my grandfather was regarded for the times, and that is the late 19th, early 20th century, as a racial progressive. He paid a black man to supervise white men at his sawmill and paid him more than the whites. He also bought one of his employees out of peonage, which is a form of indentured servitude that replaced slavery. So he was regarded as a progressive, but by today's standards, he would be very paternalistic. As for my father, I think his greatest passion was for the Constitution. He believed this man, the fact he was black didn't matter, deserved a lawyer and a good lawyer. And so my father willingly and happily took the case.
Well, wait. You said at the very beginning he wasn't all that happy because a judge called him, asked him to take it, and almost he was still at that point hoping to get out of it.
At that point, I didn't mean to convey that he was hoping to get out of it. The fact is that he was startled. He had not heard of this case. It was all over the newspapers in Troy and Montgomery, but he was in a different town. And the judge called him out of the blue and said, I want you to defend a black man charged with raping a white woman. And my father's initial reaction was, let me look at my calendar and see if I can work this in. The judge was insistent, and my father took the case quite willingly, in fact, but it was a bit of a shock to be asked, and he decided he was going to do it.
So he moved forward with this case, and he encountered a lot of difficulties. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the things that made this case particularly challenging for him as an attorney?
Well, you begin with the fact that no African Americans were allowed to serve on the jury. Two were called because of the Scottsboro case ruling a few years earlier, but they were immediately struck by the prosecution. That, by the way, is a practice that has continued in Alabama and other states until quite recently.
I want to make sure everyone stays with us. The Scottsboro Boys was the case in which there were a group, nine black teenagers accused of raping a couple white women. This was also in the 1930s, and this figures fairly large in your book and in the case that your father tried. But pray continue. He was trying to get some African Americans on the jury. He could not.
That's right, but the Supreme Court said they have to be at least called for possible service. What happens in a trial is the jurors are called and lawyers pick the ones that they want. And if a lawyer does not want any African Americans on the jury, up until quite recently, it was very common for them to come up with an excuse to strike that juror. So the two black men who were called to serve were both struck. I say men because women were not allowed to serve on that felony jury in Alabama back then.
So that was one of the first difficulties. He also did not have the defendant was very different than the defendant that we got in To Kill a Mockingbird in terms of his attitude and character. Can you tell me a little bit about the defendant in your dad's case?
Well, if you compare Charles White, who's known as Charles White alias, the defendant in my father's case, with Tom Robinson, the fictional character in To Kill a Mockingbird, there's really no comparison. Tom Robinson was obsequious, deferential, which is a way that black men had to behave back then if they didn't want to be killed. Charles White was from Detroit and Chicago, and he did not have that same deferential attitude. However, by the end of the trial, my father had come to really respect him, and there was genuine affection between the men. And I don't want to do a spoiler and tell how it turned out.
Yeah, I don't want you to either.
That affection and respect became quite mutual. And one of the nice things about the story is how their relationship developed. And in a lot of ways, I have to say, with all respect to Harper Lee, that Charles White is a much more fully realized human being. He is not a stereotype at all. He's a real character, and I came to be very fond of him as I researched him.
We would love to hear from those of you listening. Atticus Finch, clearly one of the most famous literary characters to come out of the United States. And I wonder who is a favorite literary character for those of you listening. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation that happens on Facebook. My guest is lawyer and author Joe Beck. His new book is titled My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. Along the way, one of the things that sort of helped you to write this book was not just your father's notes, but it sounds like he really spoke with you openly about many of the deeper issues behind this case and his philosophy on the law. What did you learn growing up, before you even went back to research this, what did you remember about this case?
Well, even before this case, of course, I did hear about the case and well, let me answer your question. I'm sorry. And then I want to tell you what I learned about
sure.
the law. What I heard both from my father and my mother was that this was not right, that the case came out wrongly, and that my father's career was basically ended as a result of doing the right thing, and that was not right. And in the very first sentence in the preface, I write, "My father did not sell for his worth. His sister told me that, and my mother did not disagree." What did that mean? I wondered as a child, and I go on to explain that only as an adult did I come to realize it was about this case. And, you know, the phrase "sell for his worth" is kind of a Southern aphorism, but it meant he never got the credit that he deserved. When his career was destroyed, he could not get the kind of job he wanted as a lawyer, and so he had to wind up working for the Veterans Administration in Montgomery. Now, as for what my father taught me about the law, a vivid memory that I describe in the book was the day in 1954, I think 11 years old, when the Brown versus Board school desegregation case was handed out. In Montgomery, there was tremendous negative reaction to that. Ugly words, the N-word, cross burnings, all kinds of things were going on in response to that case. The day it was decided, my father, when he got home from work, took me aside and he said, "Son, you're going to hear some high talk about this, but I want you to know that the Supreme Court decided it correctly." And he went on to explain what equal protection meant under the Constitution, and it could not continue to be justified to send blacks to a separate school because separate was inherently unequal. Now, I was 11 years old, and when he explained it, we weren't talking about the Charles White alias case. We were talking about race relations. There's another example or two in the book, including my attendance of a Jacksonville Braves game.
Yeah, tell me about your seeing a very famous ball player who's still unknown.
This is kind of on a lighter note, but it's a fact. I think I was 12 by then. We went to Jacksonville Braves Montgomery Rebels baseball game. We went to games from time to time, but we wanted to be there for this one because it was the first time that black baseball players had played in Montgomery. And there were some really ugly shouts and some taunts, and violence was threatened. We could hear it because we sat right behind the Jacksonville dugout to show our support. As the black players came out of, there were only two, came out of the dugout and stood in the on-deck circle, the shouts grew louder. But one of the players got two hits, and the second hit was a double that rattled the scoreboard. I didn't put this in the book, but I remember it as knocking the lights out, and there was about a 10-minute delay. And when the game was over, my father turned to me and he said, "Son, I don't think we'll see this man in Montgomery again next season." And sure enough, Hank Aaron was called up to the Milwaukee Braves that year. I had the pleasure of telling Mr. Aaron that when I met him a few years ago at Georgia State.
Reading this book, it occurred to me that this incident in your family's history, which had such a huge impact, not just on you and your dad, but your whole family, it really could have soured your relationship with the law, and yet you decided to be a lawyer. Why?
Well, I hate to say that, to be flip about it, but I it was not so much the inspiration as I needed to do something. I wanted to be a writer, but the law was something I did all right with and had a good career with. I did begin my career as a neighborhood legal services lawyer in Washington, D.C., representing poor people. It was in a so-called law reform program, so we took high-impact cases. One of my clients was Marion Barry, who at the time was not using any serious drugs. And we filed a lawsuit against the ABC affiliate in Washington because there were no black people on TV.
Marion Barry, you mean the former mayor of D.C.?
The former mayor of D.C. who was indicted, I guess, served time, maybe, can't remember.
Yeah, he did.
For cocaine use. And my early career was to some degree in keeping with my father in that I was giving up some income to represent people who were indigent and people who were discriminated against. I then came to the Kilpatrick Law Firm in Atlanta because it was the most progressive law firm in town. Some of the firms in Atlanta back then did not hire blacks, women, or people who were Jewish. Kilpatrick hired all three. And I've admired that in the Southern firm in 1972. Today, to their credit, the Atlanta firms are all very proactive and non-discriminatory. But back then, it was different in 1972.
Joe, we have about a minute left, and I wonder, since you have a feeling that there is a connection between your father and the character of Atticus Finch, what did you think about how Atticus Finch appeared in the second novel, Ghost Set a Watchman?
Well, as I write in the preface, my manuscript had been accepted before Ghost Set a Watchman. When I heard the book was coming out, I thought, well, that's going to be the end of mine. Even though it was accepted for publication, there would probably be a decision not to go forward. I, of course, bought the book immediately, and I was appalled that anyone would consider my father to be like the Atticus of Watchmen. But as I also make clear in the book, there were both kinds of Atticus in the South in those days. There were some white men who were brave and did the right thing. My father, Morris Dease in Montgomery, the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Judge Frank Johnson, there were many. Well, not many. There were a number.
Yeah.
There were also some vicious racists and people like Bull Connor that we know all too well.
Yeah.
But there are also some people in between, people who showed some courage but not a lot. This
right.
judge showed some courage but in protecting that defendant throughout the trial, but ultimately I think he crumbled.
That's Joe Beck, lawyer, author of the new book, My Father and Atticus Finch, A Lawyer's Fight for Justice in 1930s Alabama. The book comes out today. Joe, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today, but I wonder, we asked the question earlier, who is your favorite character in literature? May also have been from a movie, but originally from a book. Tell us who your favorite character is at OST Talk on Twitter, Facebook, or call us at 404-500-9457. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.